So we're going to conclude this hour with a discussion of a whole range of things going on in the media world right now. From the $200 million estimated loss, sadly, for the Disney sci-fi epic John Carter. Disney announced that's their estimate of what the loss will be based on the box office so far after just a couple of weekends. To the decision by Apple to do something with its $100 billion cash reserve. We learned that this week. Much of it will be a stock dividend and a stock repurchase. To the amazing story of playwright Mike Daisy's show about Steve Jobs and the working conditions at Apple's suppliers being shown to be a lot of fiction, presented as fact on the public radio program This American Life. You may have heard Ira Glass's dramatic retraction aired over the weekend. And speaking of fact and fiction as strange bedfellows, what happened to the filmmaker behind the viral documentary about Joseph Kony, 2012, Jason Russell, arrested over the weekend in another case of the messenger's difficulties complicating and distracting from a valid message? We are pleased to have with us right here in the studio, veteran journalist and founder of TheWrap.com, that's the Hollywood and media analysis website, Sharon Waxman herself. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Once again, welcome back. It's great to have you in the studio here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So let's talk about John Carter right off the bat. It's not often that any studio, let alone Disney, announces a $200 million loss. Is this a failure of Andrew Stanton, the director, a failure of Disney, a failure of the whole Pixar animators can do anything philosophy?
Oh, those are really good questions that I think everybody loses in the category. It's going to be all of the above. I mean, this was a big leap because, as you point out, this was Andrew Stanton, who's one of the stars of the Pixar galaxy, trying to take on live action. And this is you now have a couple of cases where this is happening. You've got Pixar, which has basically, you know, bats 1,000 at the box office, which no one in Hollywood has that kind of record. They just turn out hit after hit after hit. And so they're trying to move these talents into live action. And they moved Brad Bird, just did Mission Impossible 3, and that was a hit successfully. And Andrew Stanton just got, I think he just got bogged down in one of these classic cases of trying, getting, being in this bubble of
It's a hard story, too. Civil War and Mars. It's like Ken Burns meets Avatar.
Well, first of all,
it's
a freaking bad idea. Let's just start with that. I mean, they're taking a 100-year-old literary property, which has got to be really popular with a lot of dead people, and, trying to take this Andrew Rice Burroughs story. I've never read it. Did you read it?
I didn't read it. I bought it. I tried to read it, actually. It's hard for me to read on this schedule. So, again, I'm in Stanton's corner, but it is
a tough sell.
It's a tough one.
It's a great
book. Are you serious?
Yeah. It's a tough story to make into a film, but it is a great book.
We have seen, and it is reportedly, those are the kinds of things on which Star Wars is based. And Star Wars is old now, okay? So they're trying to take a genre that really is actually made for possibly an interested niche of the film going audience, which is maybe young boys. But they make this movie at this crazy bloated budget of $250 million, and I'm sure they didn't start there, but even so, it was an expensive movie. Then they had to do reshoots. Then they had to tweak it. Then they had to endure this sort of endless speculation in the media about how horrible it was going to be.
Well, part of that is because the reshoots take so much time, and there's all this sort of hanging out there, what's going on with John Carter. This is a function of the Pixar Andrew Stanton style of filmmaking, where you shoot an original script, then you do a lot of tweaking, you do a lot of reshooting, a lot of enhancements. That's where the budget went nuts.
Well, it was interesting because there was a huge New Yorker piece that ran that kind of like ratcheted up all the anticipation about this, that put this number out there that this movie has to make $700 million, which now seems laughable because it's not going to make anything close to even like two or three. We'll see if it can hit that worldwide. But that, if they hit that, then they can do a sequel because they're really trying to launch a franchise, a Star Wars-like franchise, a Pirates of the Caribbean-like franchise. So anyway, What I learned from that very long piece was that, and I didn't know, is that the Pixar films are often seem to be disasters up until like 3 weeks before they're done, and they pull some crazy thing out of the hat in terms of plot or in terms of character, in terms of tweaking it. And that, so the Pixar team, they're very used to sort of playing very close to the artistic edge as they make their movies. You cannot do that with live actions. You can't manipulate the pieces in the way that you can in a CG, in a computer graphics film.
We want to talk about the possible shift in power because Apple, of course, has cash beyond counting, while Disney is really hurting with this loss of $200 million. But just one little last question. Should the Hunger Games producers be worried about the John Carter experience?
Absolutely not. Here's the big difference. Hunger Games producers seem to have a good movie. John Carter had a rolling disaster that just got worse and worse and worse until it opened. And I mean, it's so unusual, by the way, for a studio to come out and actually announce the loss number. So what's Disney standing up and saying, okay, we massively screwed up. We're just letting you know right now, and let's put this behind us and move on.
No Tinkerbell here, that's for sure. So did it surprise you that Apple didn't announce it was buying a studio when it announced its deal on
Starbucks? Any number of Silicon Valley companies that could eat alive any one of the media, what used to be behemoths out there, and Apple's only one of them. Google's another one of them. Amazon's another one of them, although it's not in Silicon Valley. It's in Seattle. But you're completely right in pointing out that there is the shift in power. Now, I'm not going to concede that the Hollywood studios and the media companies that own them do not have massive cultural influence. They still do. Let's be clear about that. But from a financial point of view, they are starting, first of all, in terms of return on investment for investors, in terms of Wall Street, media companies are like kind of dead in the water. Sorry to say that. And
you're one.
You are
a media company.
In the rap? Yeah. We're a new media company, actually, so we fall into the better category of being on the growth curve.
Doing better than a studio. That's good. The very confident Sharon Waxman here on The Takeaway. All right, let's move to journalism meets fiction, or journalism meets entertainment. Mike Daisy did a show called The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, very successful here at the Public Theater run. Ira Glass of This American Life either saw the show or got wind of the story, put it on This American Life, where suddenly it's held to a different standard. It turns out some of the allegations, a lot of the allegations in that film, in that show, were incorrect. Mike Daisy didn't do what he said he did. A huge retraction on This American Life. What does this mean about the strange partnership between entertainment vehicles and journalistic vehicles?
To me, it just underscores that they really have to be kept extremely separate. They're two different things. What professional journalists do, and John, you and I go back to a long time back,
the Middle East,
the ground, war zones, that's real stuff. To get those stories, as you and I both know from way back then and since, you have to put it out there. You have to get the facts. You can't sort of kind of get the facts. You and I were never people who sat at the bar and waited to hear the stories and then wrote them down in our notebooks, right? We were out there talking to real people, like the much missed Anthony Shadid, who died in the course of doing that very dangerous job of getting the facts.
Well, then does Daisy get a pass as a playwright and Ira Glass take a hit as a journalist here?
Mike Daisy doesn't get a pass, but he lied. He lied. When they tried to reach his translator to fact check, that translator suddenly evaporated. And then when the Marketplace reporter, Rob Schmitz, tried to find her, he found her right away. And she verified the fact that, what's amazing to me is that Mike Daisy thought that nobody would ever check. In this world, it doesn't matter that you're alleging stuff from China, from people who don't speak English. In the global world we live in, lies aren't going to stand for very long. And what this does is this distracts from a very important issue, which is how Apple treats its workers in a global economy.
Which
treats
is still its workers, legitimate. It's supplier workers.
The workers of its vendors who still reflect on the company.
Yeah, let's be careful talking about Apple today. But it's interesting. The New York Times did a similar story, got everything right, has motivated an investigation into Apple suppliers. The story is still legitimate.
Apple has asked for an audit. It's not the same as an
investigation. Exactly. But things are moving forward. It is a legitimate story, complicated by the problems of the messenger. Similarly, the producer of the movie, the director of the movie, Joseph Kony, 2012, his weirdo kinds of difficulties have suddenly, and the license taken in that movie has really challenge the ability of humanitarian groups to focus on Joseph Kony, who is still at large, and the situation of child soldiers in Africa.
I really see that situation as more complex. Here we have something that's really quite unprecedented, where you have a filmmaker with an agenda, and a noble agenda, to bring down an international child killer who is using the power of social media to put this agenda on on the national radar, and on the international radar.
Yeah.
So that doesn't undermine what humanitarian groups are doing necessarily. He's just trying to say this can't stand. But what he's unleashed, I think he himself could never have realized the power that he was unleashing in his success. So I wouldn't say, we don't know enough yet about Jason Russell, who was found, as you say, ranting, raving, possibly masturbating.
Something I heard about at Heathrow Airport in the departure lounge. Somebody just sort of said it in conversation within hours of it happening. That's how viral that was.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I remember seeing that and I said, I can't believe it. But then when you think about it, think about the pressure that this guy was under. 80 million hits on YouTube in the space of a week and literally igniting a global movement. Every one of my friends, every one of my kids and their friends had all heard about it within 48
exactly.
hours and said, I'm signing up to participate.
Perhaps that's the new power in the media right now that
it
dwarfs even Apple. Sharon Waxman, founder of TheWrap.com, the Hollywood and Media Analysis website. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We want to hear your comments about anything media in response to what you just heard or anything you've heard on the show. And if you want to get an early jump on our conversations, you can be part of our listener response network. Sign up for our texts. Just text the word START to 69866. START to 69866. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia. Funding for Detroit coverage on The Takeaway is supported in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, WKKF.org. The Takeaway is produced by WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.